Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Administrative Law and Regulation Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, April 7, 2014, during a live teleform conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's teleform conference call. Today, we'll be discussing the Food and Drug Administration's proposed rule on trans fats. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and as always, we're recording the call for use as a podcast in the future. On our topic today, we're going to hear from two experts. As usual, only brief introductions. Their bios are available to you in the notice of today's call, and they're available on our websites as well, so I can afford to be brief in my introductions, and we'll get right to the substance. We're going to hear opening remarks of about 5 to 8 minutes from each, then maybe a little bit of back and forth, and as always, we'll turn to you for your questions, so be ready with your questions. We're going to hear first from Stuart Pape. He is a partner at Patton Boggs, and he will be followed in opening remarks by Darren Bax. He's a research fellow in agricultural policy at the Heritage Foundation. And with that, Mr. Pape, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you very much, and good afternoon, everyone. I'm going to cover three things in my initial opening remarks. I'm going to first start with just a brief statement of what partially hydrogenated oils are, how they're used, and why anybody would care about them. Then briefly provide the sort of statutory and regulatory context, which I think is necessary in order to attempt to make sense out of what FDA is doing, and then I'll have some comments on the particular tentative determination they have made. So let's jump right in. Partially hydrogenated oils are an oil with trans fatty acids that have been chemically changed from liquid to solid in order to improve their functional characteristics, principally higher melting point, increased shelf life, and improved texture. Crisco is a good, the old style Crisco that some folks may recall that came in a can and was spoonable, if you will, is a good example of a partially hydrogenated oil. They were first created and began to be used in the food supply in the early 20th century. So that's enough on PHOs. Trans, they contain trans fatty acids because of the partial hydrogenation. No one would argue today that trans fatty acids are good for you. That's not really in question. There may well be, and there is, considerable debate and discussion about the relative risk associated with extremely small quantities of trans fatty acids. So what's the statutory context? All of this FDA proceeding arises under the Food Additives Amendment to the of 1958 to the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, which is where a pre-market review system for food additives, I'll come to what those are in a second, is established by Congress. A food additive is broadly defined in the law to mean any substance the intended use of which results or may reasonably be expected to result, directly or indirectly, in it becoming a component of food or otherwise affecting its characteristics. That sweeps very broadly. But for an exception to that definition, which I'll get to in a minute, the ingredients in beef stew would each be food additives. The beef, the corn, the potatoes, everything that goes into the gravy, the carrots, every one of those things meets the definition of a food additive. If a substance is a food additive, each intended use requires a regulation setting forth the conditions of use under which the additive may safely be used. So, if I'm a substance and I meet the definition of a food additive and I don't qualify for one of the exceptions, I cannot be used unless there's a regulation authorizing the use, and then I can be used only under the conditions of use set forth in the regulation. There are several exceptions, the most notable of which is what we call GRAS, the acronym GRAS, G-R-A-S, generally recognized as safe by experts qualified by training and experience to evaluate the safety of food ingredients, safe under its intended conditions of use. All of this food ingredient regulation turns on intended conditions of use. So that's what gets the components of beef stew out of being food additive. They are generally recognized as safe. Congress did that in 1958 because there were lots of things that were used in the food supply, and it didn't want FDA or the food industry to have to go through pre-market review for things that were commonly used and were understood by everyone to be safe for consumption. Vegetable oils, sugar, salt, all those kinds of things were generally understood to be GRAS. Interestingly, unlike a food additive use, which requires affirmative FDA action to authorize the use, GRAS has been understood from the very beginning to be a status that a private person can determine, as well as FDA. Nothing that prevents FDA from saying something is GRAS, but a private person, a company, an ingredient company, a food company, a law firm, a consulting firm, anyone is entitled to assert that something is GRAS. It's called private or self-determination of GRAS status. And the risk is that if FDA doesn't agree, it can undertake enforcement action in which it says that substance or that use of that substance isn't GRAS, and therefore, if FDA is right, the use is the exception, the GRAS exception, no longer applies. Then you're back into food additive, and by definition in that hypothetical, you'd be an unapproved food additive. The ingredient would be unlawful, any food containing it would be adulterated and subject to FDA action. That's the statutory background. Partially hydrogenated oils have been widely used in the food supply for decades, earliest part of the 20th century. Their use is reflected in a variety of FDA regulations. Never formally approved per se, at least the most of the historic uses. Increasingly over the last several decades, trans fatty acids have been described by various health experts as the component of fats and oils that is most associated with chronic risk of coronary heart disease. So FDA's been doing some things in this space. Several years ago, it amended the nutrition facts regulations to require trans fats to be listed if they're present in at greater than 0.5 milligrams. Most foods were reformulated to drop the level of trans fats as low as possible, but certainly below the disclosure level. So most food labels will say zero trans fats on them. In November, FDA published a tentative determination and solicited comments, and one of the interesting issues here is the nature of the proceeding. It's not a proposal per se. We have tentatively decided that. We have a bunch of questions. Tell us what you think. Soliciting comments on a conclusion that partially hydrogenated oils are not GRAS. And if finalized, that determination would have the effect of saying that partially hydrogenated oils are unapproved food additives and therefore aren't lawfully used unless FDA were to issue food additive regulations for them, which doesn't seem likely under the notice. One thing I should point out is the standard for approving a food additive is that the food additive has to be shown to be safe under the intended conditions of use. Safe is defined as a reasonable certainty of no harm. For GRAS substances, they also must be shown to be safe, same standard, but there also needs to be general recognition. So food additives can be and often are approved based on largely or wholly unpublished, unpublic data. Something can't be generally recognized as safe. It can be shown to be safe, but can't be generally recognized as safe based on unpublished data because experts can't form a view about the safety of something, can't form a view knowledgeably if they don't have access to the material, most material safety data. So the premise of this particular tentative determination, which is an odd, unusual, tempted to say unprecedented sort of a procedural approach in the first instance. The premise of the notice is that no amount of exposure to trans fat can be said to be without an increased of risk of coronary heart disease. So therefore, no amount of added trans fat is safe. Or stated differently, that no increased risk to chronic health, no matter how small, is acceptable or is consistent with a safety conclusion. It equates unhealthy with unsafe. The statute term is safety. Traditionally, safety for food ingredients is focused on chronic risks, cancer, reproductive risks, things of that sort. Traditionally, it is thought with respect to health or nutrition-related concerns that more of things like fiber is good, less of things like saturated fat and trans fats are bad, but that there are levels of exposure consumption below what the risk is not so significant that you would prohibit the substance. This is the first time that FDA has gone down this particular pathway, and I think it is noticeable and remarkable and precedent-setting in that regard. I'm going to wrap up here and turn it over to Darren momentarily. There are lots of interesting questions about this proceeding. What else does it implicate? Some people have suggested sodium. Caffeine could be subject to a similar analysis. An interesting question about which there is no clear answer is who bears the burden of demonstrating either lack of safety or safety here. FDA has taken the position that it can simply assert, based on some evidence, but assert that it doesn't think these things are grass and that the burden then is on the industry to demonstrate that the PHOs or PHOs with some level of trans fats or some level of trans fat exposure in the diet is consistent with a finding of safety. And the comments, and there were lots of comments in the proceeding, take differing positions on that. Why don't I stop there and turn it over to Darren?
Yeah, thank you, Stuart. This is Darren Baxt. I'm going to focus more on the policy issues and not necessarily the legal issues. And I want to focus on three important points. One, that the FDA's action is unnecessary. Two, that the data doesn't support the action that the FDA wants to take. And third, as was typical with most regulations, there's going to be unintended consequences. Okay, so first, the FDA's action is unnecessary. I mean, even if you assume that the FDA should effectively ban ingredients that are allegedly unhealthy, there's been a massive reduction in the daily intake of artificial trans fat. And for lack of a better term, that's what I'm calling the trans fat from the industrial process that was discussed before. In 2003, the average adult intake of trans fat from products containing partially hydrogenated oils, I'm going to refer to that as PHOs, was 4.6 grams per day. That number plummeted to only 1 gram per day in 2012. So that's a massive 78% reduction in artificial trans fat consumption. So consumers and food producers are already reducing trans fat consumption on their own. Now, in the tentative determination, FDA argues that recent declines since 2010 aren't significant, which I find to be a really strange claim because there's been a 23% reduction from 2010 to 2012. And that decline has occurred despite the practical challenges the industry has faced as it tried to reformulate products in which PHOs are harder to replace. As you might imagine, industry is going to get rid of the reformulate products where the kind of low-hanging fruit is easier to do. And as you don't have the low-hanging fruit anymore, it becomes more difficult. This action is also unnecessary because public consumption of trans fat is already below recommended intake levels. The intake level of artificial trans fat is about half the American Heart Association's recommended trans fat intake level of less than 2 grams a day, and that's 1% of a 2,000-calorie diet. So even though the American Heart Association considers the consumption of natural trans fat as opposed to the artificial, so they consider natural trans fat in this recommended number, there's really inadequate support for the negative effect of natural trans fat. So while there may be some research showing potential health problems with natural trans fat, there's a significant amount of research that shows no association or even an inverse association. So further, even if we take into account natural trans fat consumption, so we add how much natural trans fat people consume and then add that to the artificial trans fat consumption, the total number would still be right around the recommended level of 2 grams. Okay, the second key point is that the data just doesn't support the FDA's action. So a key question is, why go below the current average daily intake of 1 gram? And the answer is inadequate support showing the need to do so. Most of the evidence, if not all really, that exists demonstrating an association between trans fat consumption and the risk of coronary heart disease are based on trans fat consumption at much higher levels than 1 gram. So in its notice, the FDA relies on a CDC study, and I'll explain that it's not really a CDC study in a second, but as the FDA explains in the notice, quote, according to the CDC, elimination of PHOs from the food supply could prevent 10,000 to 20,000 coronary events and 3,000 to 7,000 coronary deaths annually if the marginal benefits of continuing to remove trans fats from food items remain constant, close quote. This, you know, you can imagine that the coronary events and coronary death numbers are drawing a lot of attention. But two points about this data. One, the CDC calculation assumes that when you remove trans fat, you have the same marginal benefit will be achieved even at lower levels of trans fat. But that's an inappropriate assumption to make, given that many ingredients don't act in that such a manner. In fact, some ingredients, like at lower levels, such as salt, are actually required for life. And second, FDA is citing CDC that extrapolated these coronary numbers from estimates the FDA made itself. So it's almost like FDA is citing itself for this particular quote. And one issue that may not seem huge, but it just bothers me, is that the authors of that particular CDC study, it's not technically a CDC study. It was a study published in the Journal of American Medical Association. There's a disclaimer saying it's not a CDC study. It doesn't necessarily mean the study is not particularly good, but it doesn't have the imprimatur of the government behind it. And to keep stating that it's a CDC study kind of is misleading. Okay, so another question is whether FDA should be attempting to move towards zero consumption of trans fat. And the answer is no. The Institute of Medicine's 2005 Dietary Reference Intake Report, which the FDA relies on heavily in the tentative determination, and the 2010 dietary guidelines both recommend that trans fat consumption should be as low as possible. Neither recommends that individuals should seek to consume zero trans fat. Yet revoking GRAS status for PHOs is an attempt to move to zero trans fat consumption. In fact, the Institute of Medicine report goes even further, indicating that a zero trans fat diet would have undesirable outcomes. The FDA gives the impression that the Institute, in the tentative determination, the FDA gives the impression that the Institute of Medicine was just referring to natural trans fat. But the report is absolutely clear that it's talking about artificial trans fat as well. And third, major point is that there could be unintended consequences. And, you know, one unintended consequence is that you could have problematic changes in people's diets. If artificial trans fats were eliminated, it remains unclear what ingredients would replace the artificial trans fat. Consumers could choose different products to eat as a result of the reformulation of food. The replacement products consumed by individuals could lead to an overall diet that's actually worse than their current diet. There may be much needed nutrients that the public would not consume because of the changes to existing foods. Dietary decisions are extremely complex, and trying to intervene in one aspect of a diet often leads to problems in other aspects of a diet. And the federal government's experience making mistakes regarding dietary decisions should give the FDA pause. The government has a long history of steering consumer diets in a direction that actually later proves to be more detrimental than the path consumers would have otherwise been on. The 1992 USA food pyramid, for example, provides a great example. And that wasn't a de facto ban of a food ingredient. That was just recommendations. The pyramid and the guidelines it was based on encouraged people to eat carbohydrates and failed to distinguish between good and bad fats. Now, ironically, the current use of trans fat was a response to previous efforts to demonize alternative ingredients, such as saturated fat. So we're here because of efforts, not necessarily by the government, but certainly by activist groups to kind of get rid of saturated fats, and it was trans fats were a response to that. So these demonizations of one particular ingredient create problems. The history of saturated fat and trans fat illustrate the problems of trying to influence dietary patterns with scientific evidence that's constantly evolving. There's really no reason to believe that the science will not provide new information in the future that will change our understanding of trans fat. The FDA should take the time to study what it's worked on, what's worked, and regardless what it should do, and they should remember, you know, to look back at what they've done, what's worked, what hasn't, and also just not to interfere with the personal dietary choices of Americans. And that's it, Dean.
All right. Well, my thanks to both of you. Let's open the floor to questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After we hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone to indicate so. While we're waiting to see who lines up with questions here, let me make a brief programming announcement, and then I want to go back to Stuart Pate to see if he has anything in response to Darren Back's presentation. Tomorrow at 1 p.m., we'll have a special teleforum conference call on the McCutcheon campaign finance decision issued by the Supreme Court last week. That's tomorrow at 1 p.m. Wednesday at 1 p.m., we'll speak with author Joy Brighton about her new book on Sharia, and she will be joined by a return guest for Teleforum, Andy McCarthy. It's likely we'll also have a call on Thursday, but that's still in the works. Today, of course, we're speaking with Darren Baxton and Stuart Pape. If you have a question for either of them on the FDA and its trans fat rules, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And Stuart, while we're waiting to see if anyone dials in with a question, we don't have any questions yet, let me give you a chance to elaborate or respond to what Darren Back said.
Sure. One of the points I'd like to elaborate on a little bit is FDA's been under a lot of criticism about the whole GRAS process. Initially Pew Foundation and then when the leaders of that effort moved over to the Natural Resources Defense Council, and they actually just issued a report earlier today, they have been attacking the GRAS process. Part of what's happened is over the years, it used to be that a food additive regulation was what a food company or a food ingredient supplier desired, and GRAS was a more limited pathway. As the time and effort to get a food additive regulation issued stretched from years to decades, more and more companies became willing to go down the grass route. And over the last 20 years, I would say, grass has become the preferred method for new ingredients or new uses of ingredients to be introduced into food. The PUs and the NRDCs and the CSPIs of the world don't like that a bit, and they've been attacking the process, attacking the industry, and attacking FDA. I think part of what is motivated FDA on the PHOs has nothing to do with PHOs and everything to do with demonstrating that FDA is capable of monitoring and enforcing the rules regarding grass and is not simply completely asleep. Unfortunately, I think they picked a bad example, as Darren has well articulated. There are lots of regulatory options that were available to them that they seem to have skipped over, and they grabbed a sledgehammer where a surgeon's knife would have been perfectly appropriate.
I was intrigued, this is Dean again, I was intrigued by Darren Back's comment that a trans-fat-free diet is not necessarily desirable. We combine that with a list of next steps for the FDA, maybe moving towards sodium or salt or caffeine. I take it there's probably no recommended daily allowance of caffeine. There's no good amount of caffeine, but there is, salt, I take it, is a requirement for human consumption.
Yes, sodium for sure is an essential nutrient. I don't want to speak for anybody else, but a day for me without caffeine is not a good day. So, I think that's right.
Let me interrupt you and ask you: are those serious proposals? And yes, whether you answer yes or no, was it ever unthinkable that trans fats would be on the table for this regulatory question?
Well, no. I mean, you can distinguish caffeine and sodium on the one hand if you want. Sodium is an essential nutrient. If you have no sodium, if you had a sodium-free diet, you wouldn't live very long. Your heart would cease to function. The body needs sodium. The question is, how much sodium does the body need? Caffeine, for most people, caffeine is a good thing. It improves alertness. It improves focus. There's a theoretical, each person has a theoretical limit over which caffeine is not doing a good thing. Most of us know that. If I'm trying to stay up way later than I should and I drink many more cups of coffee or other caffeine-containing beverages, you can usually tell when you've had enough. So it is largely self-limiting. The question with caffeine is an interesting one, and it illustrates an issue that is evident in the PHO discussion as well. There's naturally occurring caffeine. The biggest source of caffeine in the diet for most people is coffee, and the caffeine there is naturally occurring. There's considerably more caffeine in a medium, what Starbucks calls a grande, a medium coffee, 360 milligrams on average, than there is in a large can of an energy drink, even though the energy drinks have been the subject of quite a bit of public and FDA scrutiny and controversy. I don't think FDA is thinking about banning caffeine or banning sodium, and it would be a much harder road to go down to set limits for particular types of foods. But many of the things they're saying, say in the PHO document, have relevance to these other substances, which is why one of the reasons why I think the concern level is so high.
If you have a question for one of our experts, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one caller question at this point, so let's check in with that caller now.
Hello, David Tryon in Cleveland. A couple of questions. Are these regulations now a fait accompli or not? And is there anyone that's any organized opposition to it? And then you triggered another question in my mind when you were talking about caffeine. Now that marijuana is legal in some places, some people put marijuana in their food. Is the FDA going to look at marijuana as some sort of food additive that they're going to regulate?
Well, marijuana in a brownie would certainly meet the definition of a food additive. It would be an unapproved food additive and wouldn't be lawful. It's funny you should mention that. About a month ago, I was testifying on behalf of the beverage industry in a Maryland state legislative hearing. The bill in question would have prohibited the sale of energy drinks to persons under the age of 18. While we were testifying against that piece of legislation, which the committee killed, there was a hearing a floor away to legalize the sale and distribution of marijuana in Maryland. I thought that was an interesting contrast in how legislators seem to be looking at things. But the fait accompli may be too strong a word, I guess, too strong a conclusion. I think it is more likely than not that FDA will finalize a conclusion that PHOs aren't grass. I think the big question is how much time does it allow industry to make adjustments in product formulations and find substitutes that achieve the functional effects that the company is trying to achieve, as well as meet the safety standards. The NGO side of the house in comments has suggested 12 to 18 months. The industry has tended to be more in the decade range, and it will be interesting to see how FDA sorts that out. Does it say some substitution should happen really fast, some should take a lot longer? I think that's going to be a really interesting question. The organized opposition is almost all of the you can line up the two sides of this equation very neatly. The private health organizations, Heart Association, all those folks, and the CSPIs are all on the one side of the equation, and then the food industry, trade associations, and individual companies are all on the other side of the equation.
Okay, thanks.
Darren Baxter, did you?
Yeah, this is Darren. I kind of like to go to the bigger problem, and that's the FDA focusing on something that's a health issue as opposed to a safety issue. As Stuart talked about, this is an unprecedented action. And even if trans fat is not as sympathetic of an ingredient as some other ingredient, it's really kind of a dangerous road to be going down. Stuart, you mentioned that maybe the FDA is focusing on this issue because of the criticism with the GRAS system. Certainly they could have chosen a worse option. And, it is important to note that there is a lawsuit. I don't know to what extent, Stuart, that's playing a role in it, but there's some petitions, and then the FDA has been sued to try to compel the FDA to take action on trans fat. And whether or not this action is in response to that lawsuit is unclear. The FDA in the tentative determination should have actually identified the fact that they were being sued, but they didn't. I'm not sure exactly why, but maybe that's part of it. Also, quite honestly, I do think there's a big push by the FDA to get into nutritional decision making. They're doing that here. They, in their kind of agenda, have talked about getting into focusing more on sodium. Doesn't mean they'll ban sodium, but they might regulate it in some manner. In other regulations dealing with the menu labeling, dealing with Obamacare, instead of interpreting that law to only cover restaurants, the mandatory labeling of menu items for restaurants, which is what the law really covers, the FDA has taken an extremely broad interpretation of it to cover grocery stores and convenience stores to try to kind of, and again, that's another nutritional type of issue. Now, the FDA just sent over the menu labeling rules to OMB, so it's not clear whether or not they in fact decided ultimately to go with that very broad scope of the rule, but they were. That's what the proposed rule was. So I do think it's a kind of a bigger issue at the FDA that they're going down this road to try to target our, you know, the nutritional decisions of the public, and I think that's problematic. And I think trans fat is just one example. And hopefully it's not a done deal, but certain that it might be.
We do have one other question pending at this point. If you want to add yourself to the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Yes, David Emerson, society member in Berkeley. A number of questions, but let me just limit it to just a couple. Is there, in terms of the trans fats, the naturally occurring ones versus the artificially created ones, and apparently there's quite a difference in terms of the health benefits and detriments of those. So does the FDA acknowledge this in the terms of its definition of the trans fat? And that if the industry were to respond, let's say a marketplace response, to create an artificially created trans fat with the properties of the naturally occurring ones, would that be exempt from this type of regulation to allow the marketplace to respond? The other question I have is more to do with just the, you know, strict legal analysis and whether there's any litigation afoot and what the basis would be to challenge the FDA's position on the trans fats.
This is Stuart. Let me take a crack down. You may want to comment on this as well at both your questions. There is and has been, and one of the main thrusts of the comments that a number of the industry groups, companies, and trade associations have made is that what this tentative determination does is really puts the brakes on innovation in not useful ways. There's been a lot of research that's been going on since FDA first mandated trans fat labeling as part of the Nutrition Facts Panel into ways to use, in some cases using biotechnology, in other cases not, to get the properties associated with the partially hydrogenated oils without the partial hydrogenation. And so there's high oleic soybean oil research. I think there's not adequate supply of one of the questions, not adequate supply of the oil at this point. And what this tentative determination, if FDA were to finalize it, let's say relatively soon, is put companies in situations where they might have to reformulate more than once short term due to cost or availability of alternatives that retain the functional characteristics you need, and then again when better alternatives come along, and that seems to a lot of us to be unnecessary and all the rest. There may well be litigation at, you know, at the moment it's just a tentative determination, so it doesn't have any direct legal effect. If FDA were to finalize it, I think reading the comments, there's likely to be folks who think about challenging the process. There are some folks who've argued in comments that FDA is required to go through notice and comment rulemaking. There are some folks who've argued that FDA has a burden of demonstrating the absence of GRAS. I'm not actually sure I agree with that, because the GRAS is an exception from the food additive definition, so standard notions would be the burden to establish that you qualify for an exception falls on the person who wants to claim the exception. FDA clearly has to present enough to join the issue, and I think it clearly has. It wouldn't surprise me at all if there's litigation after the FDA makes a final determination.
Yeah, this is Darren. About 1 gram of the trans fat consumption is natural. Bachelet is about 1.2 grams in 2003 or so. So it's hard to know what the exact number is. It's not clear whether or not natural is absolutely better or not as problematic, but the research certainly suggests that. Stuart when he was talking about kind of the different reformulations and having to reformulate a couple of different times. I mean, one of the problems is that, first of all, some companies will just be no point in continuing to pursue some type of artificial trans fat that has the same type of properties as the natural. Won't be a trans, yeah, I mean, won't be worth it. Might as well go to whatever's the next, whatever the substitute will be. Seems kind of a waste to kind of have double the cost. And the idea of, it was mentioned before, about 12 to 18 months to reformulate, it would be kind of crazy. Hopefully it would probably take years. And one thing that has been brought up is FDA has not really done a cost-benefit analysis at all. There is no CBA whatsoever. It's not clear what the impact is going to be on businesses. There's certainly going to be some small businesses that may not be able to ever reformulate their foods at all. And consumers are, even if food is reformulated, it's not going to have the same taste, so that there is a cost to that. It may not have the same shelf life, because one of the benefits of the artificial trans fat is to have a longer shelf life of the food. So you lose that benefit. So those are certainly, and the texture itself of the food product. So there are certainly some costs involved, and certainly the cost for the companies of actually going through the reformulation. And we have to keep that in the context of the fact that we're only talking about only 1 gram of artificial trans fat on average for the daily intake, which is extremely low. And the fact that the slope is basically that the public and food companies there's just a lot less consumption. So it's like they're jumping the gun to take any type of action right now. And on the legal front, and besides the process issues, which I think are kind of complicated, because I don't really even know what this tentative determination is, whether or not they notice and rule when, you need to have rulemaking or not. But there's also the issue of prior sanction, which means that Stuart can explain this probably better than I can, but at least in the comment that I submitted, the argument was that if an agreement before 1958 was sanctioned by the FDA before 1958, I forget the exact date, 1958, then the burden then does shift to the FDA. So one of the things I wanted to establish was that even though there may not be an express prior sanction, so the FDA may not have said in 1948 that partially hydrogenated oils are perfectly fine and we think it's great for use in, butter. It's not necessarily, it can be established through what are called standards of identity, which kind of list the ingredients and the use for that particular ingredient in a particular type of food item. And using some of these standards of identity combined with just the historical use can help to establish that the FDA, in fact, did sanction partially hydrogenated oils before 1958. I try to make that case. How well I did make that case, I don't know. But it was mentioned by a couple of commenters, and it's particularly important because the one clear way to change the shift the burden to the FDA is to make it clear that the FDA did sanction PHOs before 1958. And if that could be shown, then that would change things dramatically. And Stuart, I don't know what your take is on that.
Yeah, I think the prior sanction is one of the other exceptions. It's based on the proposition that before the law was amended in 1958, companies often consulted with FDA about an ingredient. Is this okay? There was often correspondence. Sometimes ingredients were reflected in other non-ingredient-specific regulations in ways that reasonably indicated that FDA approved of the use of the ingredient. If there is a prior sanction, it takes that use out of the food additive law and, in fact, would dramatically shift the burden. It's I think there's lots of good evidence. Darren has mustered a lot of it in the comment he did. There's a lot of good evidence to support the proposition that many of the uses of partially hydrogenated oils do, in fact, have a prior sanction. That would change the whole character of the proceeding, and it'll be very interesting to see how FDA deals with that issue.
Has FDA taken a position on that, or are they implicitly taking a position? And
well, traditionally, what they do in these kind of proceedings is sort of have boilerplate that says we're not aware of any prior sanctions. Just even if they are, they say we're not aware of any prior sanctions. So if you have any evidence of a prior sanction, you better submit it to us. And then if you submit good evidence of a prior sanction, again, prior sanction is a historical. You're trying to prove a historical event or sequence of events. You don't have to prove that the prior sanction use is safe. You're simply trying to prove here. Look, in 1952. This person wrote to this senior official at FDA and said, is it okay to use this in this context? And this person, was senior person, wrote back and said, yes, we have no objection to that. That would be a prior sanction. FDA didn't seem to – this wasn't sort of, a fully baked tentative determination. It was unusual in lots of respects. It's almost like another thing that was unusual is most people who do, I'm a practicing food and drug lawyer, virtually every food and drug practitioner in the country was surprised when this notice came out, which is not the way our world works. It was almost as if this thing was lurking around and then they suddenly decided we got to get something out on this, and out it came. So there will be consideration of the prior sanction. There has to be, otherwise that would be a real problem for FDA not to deal with it. That would make it quite vulnerable to a lawsuit. So I think they'll address it, but it's curious that they waited until the very end.
And again, the existence of a prior sanction affects who has the burden in determining safety.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
This is Darren, and I should point out the Competitive Enterprise Institute did a FOIA request to send it to FDA at least a few weeks before the end of the comment period, asking for records relating to prior sanction. So, nothing else. We'll try to get that information.
Well, you mentioned
but
I was going to say, once again, if you have a question in the audience, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And while we're waiting to see if others ring in, Stuart Pape, you mentioned this came as a surprise to virtually everybody practicing law in this area. I think it came as a surprise to the public, too, although not a shock, I suppose. Maybe the timing was a surprise, but the fact of the attempted regulation here was not a shock. Has there been much of a public outcry or backlash, or do you expect there to be, or how's this being received?
I mean, the on the public side of things, these are trans fats are terrible. No molecule of them should be allowed. This is the food industry trying to kill us. I mean, all the sort of public, if you will, small p public, I guess, side of things is very much in favor. There's a lot of grassroots activity out there to sort of generate by the NGOs, the CSPIs of the world, and the health organizations to, get the trans fats out of my food. Puts the industry in an awkward position because they're, being painted as defending the continued use of unsafe, unhealthy ingredients in food.
Indeed, this is Darren. I think that the problem is that, like I said before, this trans fat is not the most sympathetic ingredient, so it doesn't necessarily garner the concern of the public as much. But that's why it's certainly been important in my work to try to do what I can to communicate the fact that this is a bigger issue than simply just all about trans fat. It is an unprecedented action by the FDA. And one thing is, once I do write about this, and really kind of any food ingredient type of issue, or any issue relating to the government trying to interfere with dietary choices, the public's extremely interested, at least in kind of our community, in our base, when I blog on it or send out, do a report or whatever, there's a lot of attention. So there's a lot of interest when we get the issue out, but it's important that we get the issue out.
You've mentioned a couple times, Darren, and maybe you did too, Stuart Pape, that there has been a sort of voluntary reduction in the consumption of trans fats over the past decade or even more. Has the FDA acknowledged that in its recent actions? Or
yeah, actually, they in the press releases, they tout that. They talk about how there's been these massive reductions, but it's just, but they then say, well, you know, it's not good enough. They mentioned that the 2010 and 2012, they don't think that reduction was big enough. There's concern that there's still going to be some people that will consume trans fat at higher levels and got to protect those populations. So, you know, it just seems that they don't really address
the argument. Is the argument that those folks who would continue to consume on a high level are unable to make an informed decision, so we have to ban it for everyone, or what is the rationale there?
Yeah, that's not the rationale is, and I think this is a point in which there's considerable debate, but FDA's rationale is there is no amount of added trans fat in the diet that is without incremental risk. And that incremental risk, and they don't really seek to characterize it, and it would be hard to do, but they essentially assume a linear relationship so that if there's a risk at X and consumption has dropped to half X or a quarter of X, there's still a risk at the quarter of X. And it's that lower exposure amount, the remaining added trans fat in the diet, because companies, you know, as I said before, reformulated products with the label requirement to get down to a level that wouldn't trigger a disclosure, but there's still, in places where there isn't a label, like food service or restaurants, except in those localities like New York City where they've banned trans fats. So part of what you're seeing here is FDA catching up with some of the more aggressive public health, quote-unquote, oriented municipalities. There's still trans fats being added to food and therefore incrementally adding to the risk even at low levels. That's the premise.
Got it. Well, it looks like we're out of questions, but we have a couple of minutes. Let me see if we want to if you have any final thoughts here, and why don't we go in the same order we started. Stuart Pape, a final thought?
I think this is, I don't expect FDA to make a decision on this very quickly. There's a lot in the docket. It's going to be quite controversial. The consumer groups will continue to put pressure on FDA to finalize this so that they can move on to the next target. The attack on the food industry, the attack on grass ingredients will continue unabated.
Darren Baxt, final thought.
Yeah, I do think this is a part of a bigger attack on the food industry and also nutritional, that kind of dietary decision making. I think there's a couple of different things going on. There is an assumption, and it may not be listed in the tentative determination, but it's certainly listed in the preamble of the menu labeling rule, where there's just a kind of an underlying assumption that the public is not able to make dietary decisions on their own and that government intervention is required. Now, I simply don't, you know, buy the – I don't think there's a – this is not a safety issue. This is a health issue. Unfortunately, the law might be broad enough to allow FDA wiggle room to be able to interpret it the way they are, but I think Congress – hopefully, we'll need to kind of step in, not allow a safety law to be turned into kind of a dietary law by the FDA. And it's kind of interesting, the FDA is very concerned about the costs involved with implementing some Food Safety Modernization Act legislation. It's a massive statute that they're implementing right now. But at the same time, they're concerned about implementing that law. They're diverting attention and resources to these other matters, these other issues like this particular issue, the trans fat issue, which is, you know, that's money and resources that could be devoted to implementing the food safety statute, which is far more important than this.
Well, I want to thank you both for your participation today. We certainly appreciate your time and your thinking on this. Thanking Darren Baxt of the Heritage Foundation and Stuart Pape of Patent Boggs. To our audience, thank you also for dialing in. A reminder that tomorrow at 1 p.m. we'll be discussing the Supreme Court's recent decision last week in the McCutcheon campaign finance decision. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.